So that's the microphone.
Our furry little friend.
Absolutely.
And what do we do?
You hold it like you would,
Oh, hello.
Like a sort of stand-up kind of.
My stand-up routine. I'm here available for bar mitzvahs and weddings and here all week, ladies and gentlemen.
Mate straights.
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to keep equalising, as you can see.
Sure. For the listeners at home.
Yes.
Adam is holding his nose.
And blowing out my ears. I seem to have
a blockage. I don't think it's a blockage. I think it's just a small infection.
This is a great B-roll for the start. Yeah. We'll fade into the music now. Away from the infection.
Yeah, spieling with the ears.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. You'll know my guest this episode from his work across stage and screen, perhaps from his roles in Dr. Foster, Vigil, Belgravia, The Buccaneers, The Suspect, You, Miranda, Johnny English Strikes Again, Charles III, Consent, I May Destroy You, Hotel Portofino, Extras, Jonathan Creek, or even Doctor Who. Or, if you're watching this sometime after November 2024, the movie adaptation of Wicked. I first saw him as Don Pedro in 2011's Much Ado About Nothing, and I've been a huge fan ever since. Earlier this year, we met for the first time in maybe the most theatrical setting possible, a matinee of Sam Mendes' The Motive and the Cue at the National Theatre here in London. And that, coupled with the amount of work he's done with The Nash, made me feel like the best place to record our interview would be the National Theatre. And the National Theatre agreed and granted us special permission to record our episode in their building, for which I'm incredibly grateful. Across our conversation, we discuss quite what makes the National Theatre so great, along with what makes a good director, performing on Broadway versus West End, the theatrical value of table tennis, playing Ariana Grande's father in one of the biggest productions ever filmed, and so much more. In fact, we're already planning a part two. So, let's get straight into it. Please welcome my guest for this episode, Adam James. Adam, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Complete pleasure. Thank you for asking me. Thank you for having me. I was very flattered that you deemed me worthy enough of your podcast.
Of course. I've been a huge fan of your work for over a decade.
Oh, that's incredibly kind.
And I normally say this before we start rolling, but I've done a whole bunch of research.
Oh, God.
The HMRC, I'm very...
The lawyer on speed dial. Exactly. Cancelled any minute.
But feel free to go off into any... It's your episode. I'm just a shepherd of it.
Okay.
So any anecdote you want to go off
right.
in a 10-minute thing.
Okay.
Absolutely
I'm happy
fine.
To be herded.
Wonderful. So we're here at the National Theatre.
Yes.
First time we're recording the episode here.
Oh.
I thought it'd be a particularly good location because of your connection to it.
Absolutely.
Do you remember the first time you came here as an audience member and then as an actor?
Oh, yes, I do. I remember vividly the very first time I came here as an audience member. I would have been, oh my gosh, I think in my late teens, I think I was, oh, I remember it so well. I was basically taking a girl on a date and desperately trying to impress her. And I think I must have been 18, 19. Yeah, I reckon I was 18, 19. And she'd previously been a girlfriend of mine earlier on in school.
Okay.
And we'd somehow reconnected post-school and before or post-A-levels or I don't know. Anyway, we're both in London. I thought, I'm going to take you to the National Theatre. And I got tickets to go and see The Trackers of Oxyrhynchus.
Okay.
You know, a classic date.
Exactly.
Classic date night play.
Screams romance.
Screams romance, comedy, and light entertainment. And it was at the Olivier. And it was absolutely extraordinary because, of course, it isn't a perfect date play to go and see. But this adaptation, I do seem to recall... The chorus all seem to have the most enormous pendulous penises as part of their costume.
Okay.
So whenever they would, you know, sing or come together as a chorus, they would also do a movement that would have this enormous appendage flying around. So I couldn't work out if that was a good or a bad thing. There was sort of a lot of sideways looks to my girlfriend at the time. But I do remember being struck at the space, particularly of the Olivier.
Not literally, I assume.
Not in the eye. No, at that point I could barely afford tickets, so we were way up in the gods. So we were safe from swinging penises. But they were of such a scale that you could still see them vividly, even far back as we were up in the gods. But I do remember thinking, what an extraordinary space that is. And what a venue and what a location, because, you know, sort of slightly stereotypically or cliched, it's been captured a few times now on film. Post theatre, we then did promenade along the South Bank here and had a sort of romantic moment in the fairy lights and the Thames sort of gurgling behind us. And it's just an incredible place and an incredible building. And then when I was training, or just before training, it sort of became this impenetrable fortress. I thought, am I ever going to get to work there? Am I ever going to be seen or considered for something? And it felt like such a long time before that happened. And it was certainly long after I'd left drama school, before I was given permission into this building. And it's funny, isn't it? When you have preconceived ideas or perceptions of a place that you want to attain or aspire to, and then of course you get here, and all my expectations were fully met. It is literally the best place to do a piece of theatre. But I was also struck by how quickly it becomes that. Oh, yeah, just. I'm back at the Nash again.
Yeah,
you know. So the mystique and the aura of it soon becomes familiar, and you feel very at home here. As opposed to, I remember literally staring at it across the river from Somerset House, going, "When am I ever going to work in that building? It's insane." And having seen so much stuff here during my drama school years, when it was under, I think it was at the end of Richard Eyre's tenureship here. Mm-hmm. And I do remember having, I may have romanticised this slightly, but I do remember thinking it was extraordinary. You could rock up on spec here and see an extraordinary piece of theatre in any of the three theatres when rep was still very much the thing. And I think that was one of their hopes, is that in a 2-week period, you could see at least 9 plays, maybe even more.
Wow, I didn't know it was that in that quick rep a period. Turnaround.
Yes, they would turn them around. So, yeah, I did. I fell in love with the building and with a lot of productions that I've seen here. I think it's an extraordinary place, and I was very happy to finally breach its walls.
Was that in Blood and Gifts or 13 or Consent?
No, which is the very first play I did here was a David Hare play called Gethsemane.
Oh, right, sure.
Directed by the late, great Howard Davies. And honestly, it was properly like a dream come true, like national, brand new David Hare play, David Hare in the room, with one of our greatest theatre directors, in my opinion, that I'd ever worked with. And like a caster before they were famous. We had a sort of young Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Jessica Raine, Dan Ryan, Tamsin Gregg, Anthony Carf, Stanley Townsend, Nicola Walker. I mean, we had all these amazing talents. And I sat in the rehearsal room sort of agog. And it was everything you hoped. It was sort of more than an extension of drama school. You were in the best place you felt you could be for theatre, watching these great experienced people. And you sort of learned exponentially. And I only had one scene. It was a sort of 20-minute scene, but it opened, I think, the second half of the play. Mm-hmm. And it was set in a sort of trendy, like, vodka bar. And I played this sort of shitty journalist. And the scene was between me and Gugu Mbatha-Raw and Nicola Walker. And it was just thrilling. I loved every minute of it, from, you know, the design, I remember we did rehearsals early on, and because it was set in this bar, had us saying, okay, well, we should probably, you know, you see the model box and the design. And he said, okay, I think we're going to set it around a bar and we'll have these, you know, bar stools or variations of. So in rehearsals, we said, well, we should probably get an assimilation of that. And I remember we broke for tea, tea break and we came back and stage management had got, and I'm not exaggerating, about 20, 25 different rascals of every conceivable shape, size, height, variation. I thought, Jesus Christ. It was just brilliant. That's the metaphor of this. Everybody is at the top of their game. Nothing is a problem. Everything can be achieved. And that's why such great work gets done here. And I remember thinking, oh, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I also remember, because I wasn't on until the second half, and it was at the it was, as it was then called, the Cottesloe, now the Dorfman. Anthony Carf and I, rabid table tennis fans, and the Scene Doc guys set up a table tennis table in the Scene Doc at the Cottesloe. So for the first half of the play, Anthony and I are playing like demons. Who knew that it's the most perfect way to prepare for a play? It sort of gives you all that mental acuity, sure. Like your brain is sharp as a tack. You've physically moved around and woken up your body. I then, at the interval, would go and have a shower and prepare as a journalist, going to prepare to meet someone in a vodka bar for a dodgy interview. And it was, I think it's the most method I've ever been, but it was brilliant. I'll never forget it. It was a very, very happy time, an incredibly happy company, as is often the way with big and eclectic casts in terms of age range and diversities and different backgrounds. It was wonderful. We used to do this on matinee days. We used to do tea, and every week someone else would bring in a cake, and it was joyful. And everything I hoped the National would be, full of integrity. Nothing was not doable or achievable, and properly comprehensive. I so loved it.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, and I miss Howard. I worked with him, as you mentioned, on Blood and Gifts again, and also at Chichester. I sort of slightly loved Howard a bit. He became a sort of weird fraternal mentor father figure that I'd never had. I always kind of loved, just beneath the veneer of sort of cool, calm exterior, there was always a raging, red-blooded Welshman. And, I enjoyed him enormously. I thought he was great. So that was my intro into the National Theatre, and I fell in love with every aspect of it because, as I say, you're in rep as well, so you have this privilege of doing a play for a certain period of time. You then get a break while another show goes in, and then you have these brilliant things called bringbacks. We all come back together as a company and you go through the play again.
Yeah.
But you do it sort of in a slightly relaxed fashion, and weirdly, by virtue of doing that, new things could suddenly appear. But also you come to the play afresh again. It never gets stale or tired. It's not like doing an interminable, long West End run. And of course you had the freedom to then know that you're working, still be paid, but take a small break. Yeah. When as a actor do you ever have the security to really go away? The old adage of book a holiday and then get a job.
Sure.
There was all those sort of considerations that make working here so, so wonderful. And, as I said before, you get to see all these other brilliant shows at the same time.
Well, going from one great theatre director to another.
Yes.
Rupert Gould.
Yes.
With King Charles III.
Yes.
I loved it as an incredible piece.
Thank
that,
you.
That shifted across, well, I suppose really two mediums, but it, with different levels of stages, because you started at the Almeida, and then West End and Broadway, and then the TV film, if I got it in the right order.
I think you have. I think we did almost every iteration, apart from a video game. I think we
There's
did
still time.
We did three versions of it. We did a radio play of it as well, actually.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I wonder if that was before we went to Broadway. And then you're right, a TV film of it.
How does... first of all, what is Rupert Gould like as a director? And how did that project shift between the different forms that it went through?
Rupert Gould is a director. Again, he's kind of a thrilling energy to be around. He runs a really brilliant room. Again, a lot of the skill of a director is the casting and sort of curating a particular cast and an aesthetic within that, mm-hmm. which I think he's superlative at. Also, what I've what I uniquely enjoy about Rupert is I always feel like if you could peel back or peel forward his front, the skin on his sort of forehead.
Sure.
I'd feel like there are about 42 different television screens playing at the same time inside his brain. He's got such a visceral and quick mind, full of ideas and introspections and thoughts. So I always find it incredibly invigorating working with him. I always enjoy being in the room with him, and I think he brings the best out in everybody. And it's not a precious room ever. It's very free and massively creative. The last play I did with him was an Anne Washburn play, which was bold and ambitious and big in its sort of ideas and scale and quite dense. And I remember being very, very quiet deliberately during that rehearsal because there were a lot of really, really clever people in the room, which was thrilling, really, really enjoyable. And that's my memory of him. He's got a great mind and a great intellect that he wears very, very lightly and doesn't make you feel less than or more stupid as a result of.
What do you want from a director? I speak because I'm a stand-up director as well as a podcaster. And I'm always curious as to what performers want directors to show them to give them. What in your view makes a good director?
In my opinion, I think it's a way of unlocking something or presenting something without it being overly explicit. That for me is a skill, whether that's done in an anecdote or a description of something or a sense of something. You also have to trust them and trust their aesthetic a bit as well. And I think I've been very lucky to work with the group of directors I have who all, in my opinion, do have an incredibly, have got great taste, really good taste. But yeah, I think for me, it's a conciseness in the note giving and the way in which that is delivered. Howard always used to give you an idea of where he'd like you to go through a small story or a feeling of something. And I always found that very, very effective for myself. And often the really good ones, if you'll just leave you alone to do it rather than convoluting or complicating. Those qualities I find very useful in the directors that I've worked with.
So taste and concision.
Yes,
and
taste.
Vision.
Yes, taste, concision, and a vision and a way of communicating it without being overly explicit or literally doing it for you. And I've had a rare occurrence where directors who give specific line readings, and that's quite interesting. Although Peter Gill does it, he is a great director, but he does have a propensity for giving certain actors particular line readings. That's always quite an interesting moment. But he's also a weird one. I remember thinking, is he ever going to direct us? And then you realise what he's done is it's like a process of osmosis. We did this play called. It was based on Lulu, and it was myself and Andrew Scott. We did it at the Sheffield Crucible. Grandage was doing a season of Peter Gill plays.
Mm.
And it was quite an extraordinary process. But by some weird process, as we came to the tech or as we came into the theatre, all the last couple of runs, I thought, God, he's somehow hewn and crafted this piece. And I wasn't aware of any broad brushstrokes of directing whatsoever. It did really feel like osmosis.
That's amazing. So returning to King Charles III and
yes.
Looking more broadly, because you've done multiple shows on Broadway as well as here. If I'm writing, say.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. How does Broadway differ from the West End? I remember you've spoken before about Tim Pigott-Smith in Charles III getting annoyed at the loudness of the Broadway audiences, as opposed to here. Just in terms of like coughing, I assume, and not just like joining
in. Oh, no,
in.
There's food and oxygen tanks and... there's a slightly more vocal interactive audience in a way that we don't anticipate or hadn't anticipated previously. Although I do think now audiences have changed massively. I do think audiences, particularly in the West End, like, you know, you hear, like in some of those big musicals, like security guards having to get involved, and people rock up completely.
There were riots in, I think, the Bodyguard a few months ago.
Well, that's right.
And people were nearly killed by, like, falling off banisters and
it's
things like.
It's a really strange process we're going through, where the medium has somehow got blurred with going to the cinema or watching TV, and people feel they have the same freedoms.
Sort
or,
of like the goggle boxification.
It's odd. And yet, having said that, you know, across the, just down the river from us, we've got the Globe.
Yeah.
And of course, in Shakespeare's day, the Pit was, you know, a heaving mass of all sorts of things going on. So it's weird that we have this preciousness that it's an art that needs to be received in some semblance of silence. And there's a, you know, a mutual understanding that that's the case and a mutual concentration. But it is definitely shifting.
Hmm.
But for the purposes of King Charles, when we're at the Almeida and in the West End compared to Broadway,
it
was definitely a bit more vocal. And there's a bit of maybe lost in translation, or it would ebb and flow, actually, because there would be a great sycophancy or fascination, particularly from an American audience, about a play about the, you know, future King of England or the royal family.
Sure.
But yes, I think the example I mentioned to you, I remember there was one night where you just felt they were restless or not concentrating or something in the audience. And I remember we were all on stage, and Tim had a series of sort of soliloquies or speeches out to the audience to give. And it was a bit of a trick that he did, but I thought, oh, that's so clever. And all he did is he just brought the volume of his speech down slightly, and suddenly felt the audience equally go a bit more quiet and concentrate more and slightly lean forward in their chairs. And I thought, that's genius. And, you know, the side of an old pro as well.
Yeah.
And, that, you know, that's great. You know, you get to see these brilliant little tricks or skills that more experienced actors among us have learned to do.
Is there another one that springs to mind of a sort of where you've witnessed a great actor or a great director have a sort of particular trick, just one particular sort of move that can affect in that way? That's really impressed you, that's made you go, oh, that's good, I'm having that.
There's always something about being live and present in the moment, whether it's on film or stage. And I've always enjoyed working with or watching actors who can really embody that. I did a tiny part in a film called Last Chance Harvey with Emma Thompson and Dustin Hoffman.
Of course, yeah.
And we had this sort of slightly, it was one of those all-day things. We were stuck in a restaurant. It was a big sort of dinner, post-wedding dinner scene. And inevitably, people's energies ebbs and flow and, you know. And I remember Dustin has this sort of entrance. He joins the party a bit late. And we're all meant to sort of give funny looks or odd reactions. And we'd done a series of that. And then without telling us, and maybe not even the camera team, maybe he consulted the director. He came in and there were some like loose stones as part of the decoration of the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And he just went through the stones as though he'd come a cropper. He sort of fell through the stones, which of course made the most awful noise and shocking noise. And the whole table reacted instinctively. Genius. So those kind of things are impressive.
Yeah.
But they can also backfire, you know. I mean, you might want to speak to Meryl Streep about working with Dustin Hoffman on Kramer versus Kramer. I think he did similar things and maybe they didn't go down quite as well.
I've heard the stories I think you're alluding to.
So, yes.
Fantastic. Well, you mentioned about the Globe and one particular version of Shakespeare that you performed that I loved was 2011's Much Ado About Nothing. Incredible stellar cast again.
Yeah.
You're Don Pedro to David Tennant's Benedict, Catherine Tate's Beatrice, Elliot Levy's Don John. What are your memories of that production?
Ooh. Dom, I've got some stories about that show. Whether they can all make the podcast or not, I don't know. Yeah. Where do we start?
I didn't realize it was
that?
Such a rich stream.
Yes. I'm not sure all of them are broadcastable. But the overwhelming takeaway from it is because of the massive popularity of David and Catherine at the time, we were obviously drawing in huge audiences. I think the show sold.
Yeah.
Sonia said, please, you know, she could have sold the show for another 6 months.
Yeah.
And so always bringing in, hopefully, a new audience into it, or a younger audience generation into it, it is thrilling. And it was a very broad, slightly outlandish production of that play. I mean, I believe Catherine, you know, just prior to her Gulling scene, used to maybe do a bit, 5 minutes of stand-up. I mean, it was sort of extraordinary. But the audience absolutely loved it. So it was wonderful to be part of that and witness the effect that can have. Mm-hmm. But inevitably, with sort of slightly long runs, there's lots of bad behaviour and messing around, endless corpsing. But the play and the world of it could sort of contain it. And I think an audience always sort of slightly enjoys that. It was a very happy show to my memory. And it was great to work with, you know, David and Catherine, David is an old friend of mine. To get to work with Catherine, who I then worked again with subsequently, was lovely. But yeah, it was a right rollicking time, I seem to recall.
And now, what is one of the stories you've been picturing whilst doing the very sanitised version?
Doing the desanitised version,
No, the very sanitised overall general picture you've painted.
Yes.
Whilst clearly picturing some...
Yes.
Some potentially career in...
Yeah, well, there was certainly a very a particular incident, which I won't go into at this point, but... it was the irony of that was not lost on the entire cast.
Okay, we'll move swiftly along before lawyers
get
start
myself
approaching.
Into all sorts
exactly,
of trouble.
Exactly. Well, how do you then approach Shakespeare? How do you, how do you approach Shakespeare?
I haven't done much Shakespeare actually. I don't know actually how I would approach. I suppose I approached it like any other play. I was trying to think. Yes, there's always the sense of being slightly intimidated by the language, or getting to grips with the language, making it accessible to yourself, making it accessible for an audience too. But the truth is, I don't think I've done enough professional Shakespearean productions to really know if I've got a particular process when doing a Shakespearean play. My memory of it, though, is when you are on song, for want of a better word, when you are sort of intuitively at one with the text and really feeling it, it is sort of, it elevates you. It is language of the epic. It is a broad world in which you then exist. And that's quite thrilling when you get that really, really right. But the majority of my work has been a lot to do with new writing, and that I feel is where my real interest and passion lies. I have vain hopes that in years to come I'd love to do Lear, or I still feel I'd quite like to do Macbeth as well. God, are we allowed to do that? Do we now have to go outside and turn around and spit three times? We've actually said it in a theatre, Dom. What do we do?
I believe...
Scottish play. We
can bleep it out. The only bleep we've ever had in this podcast will be for the name of their play.
For the name of the play, the Scottish play.
Although I believe if we study the exact Shakespearean academics, if you say it in the cafe of a theatre, it's fine.
Is it?
So
we haven't cursed tonight's productions at the National then.
Well,
we'll have to wait and watch.
Having waxed so lyrically about it at the start, that this theatre now has to close permanently in 45 minutes time.
Apologies.
It had a good run.
Apologies, National. But yes, I do have a hope to do... But, David, for example, has always been very keen on, I think, literally ticking off, working through the canon of plays. It's something that he's been very passionate and keen and clear to want to do in a way that has never... I haven't had the same sort of ambitions. Although when you see a terrific Shakespeare, it's properly transporting and transformative. But yes, I don't have I haven't got a burning desire to knock out the Richards or the history plays or maybe some of the baddies. They're quite like Posthumus. He's quite interesting. They don't often do Cymbeline, maybe for good reason. But we'll see. Maybe in my later stages, I might do some of the great old. I would like to do Lear. Lear could be great. Yeah, at some point. So, yeah, so sorry, really, to answer your question, there is no specific technique. I just try to find, you know, as with everything, the truth of the situation that your character finds yourself in. There was quite a neat little thing that I played with or explored in Much Ado, that Don Pedro has an infatuation and a love of Beatrice.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where we could explore that, and he sort of gets rebuffed and rejected, and that's quite interesting. But yeah.
In previous interviews, we've spoken about how it's the human condition is what really attracts you to a role.
Yeah.
So that entirely tracks, that it's the personage as opposed to a fantastical concept, or a sort of, you look for the inner truth to connect on a human level. Is that right?
I think so, because I think that's what we ultimately are coming to the theatre for, and telling these stories, is it gives us a pause for thought to see where we are in the world, what the world is doing, to be entertained, to laugh, to be moved, to see ourselves reflected to some degree. So those intentions are strong for me to try to replicate.
Connecting to, you mentioned David a lot during that, and of course you were in one of the Christmas specials during his time in Doctor Who.
This is true.
And what I didn't realise until I started researching for the interview was who your godfather is.
Yes.
One of the greater of them.
One of the iconic Doctor Who's.
Your godfather is, of course,
John Pertwee.
What was he like as a person, as a godfather, as a...
Listen, I didn't really get to know him really at all as a human being. I was far too young. To me, he was always Wurzel Gummidge.
Sure.
And there was a particular Christmas at my aunt and uncle used to have a hotel just outside of Bristol. And as a treat, and unbeknownst to us, John, who was a great friend of theirs as well, came dressed as Wurzel Gummidge. And of course, we were all...
Incredible.
Giddy.
Yeah.
Because that was the show, the children's show of the time.
Yeah.
I have a vague recollection of him coming to see me do a school play when I was at school in Bristol at Clifton College, and being very sort of generous and supportive. You know, there was me sort of, you know, suggesting that it was a, you know, career I wanted to follow. And unlike me, to many, when I'm asked, you know, particularly so my daughter's now showing some interest in becoming an actor, and I'm sort of broken hearted and like, oh God, avoid it like the plague. He was quite the opposite. He was very generous about it. So, yeah, those are my sort of fleeting memories of him in my life. But, yes. And also to be part of that that huge part of television history, I really wanted to do it, and it was incredible. It was fortuitous. I was actually at the National doing a play at the time, which one I don't remember. I don't know if it was Blood and Gifts or if it was 13, but again, it was in rep, and so we had a 2-week period off, and my director friend James Strong was directing the Easter special of Doctor Who, and said, look, there is this part of a policeman, would you be interested? And I was like, jumped at the chance, and totally by a quirk of fate, the filming dates and our hiatus from the National worked out beautifully.
Oh, amazing.
So off we went, and of course I wanted to be in it while David was still being the Doctor, and it was great. It was great to have that little bit of, you know, continuity in television history sort of ticked.
Yeah.
Those were the days when you could sort of do those things whilst working at the National, whereas now I understand that they all play straight through. I think the rep doesn't exist in the same way for various reasons.
Well, we've got a hard out, and I'm going to keep to that hard
Thank
out.
Thank you.
So we've got exactly 12 minutes before this hard out.
So much to cram in.
But we've got 10 minutes for this and 2 minutes of polite chat, and then we'll get you on your way.
Wonderful.
But I couldn't let you go without talking about Wicked.
Right.
You're playing the role. It's been released. I know I can say this.
I've checked with all the
actors. Yeah. You're playing the role of Glinda's father.
Apparently.
You've heard the rumours that I have.
We can't get too excited about this. I mean, if I even make a frame of the film, it will be a small miracle. The scale of this movie is bonkers. And for those who are living in a cave or have been under a rock and don't know who's playing Glinda, it's Ariana Grande. So I assure you, all of the attention, every single camera angle will be, quite rightly, on my daughter. If my moustache creeps into a frame at some point, or my rather beautiful costumed hat, wonderful. But please don't hold your breath and expect any semblance of a performance from me in this monster of a... Well, two films we've actually filmed.
Yeah.
Two films. They shot two back to back. And of course, we had to... We were 10 days before the end of the whole shoot, and they've had to down tools because of the SAG strike that's ongoing. But in spite of being a tiny cog in this massive machine, it was thrilling to be involved on something of that scale, particularly as, of course, there will be CGI in it, but predominantly... They were harking back to sort of the old Hollywood films, and they built the most extraordinary and
massive sets. I've seen the long lens shots in like Hertfordshire or wherever.
And drones.
I mean, drones
take all these shots. They were trying to all keep it under wraps, but...
So similar to the original Oz in those big-scale sort of MGM style.
You might have to check this, but I believe Paul Tazewell, who was the designer, was suggesting that I think maybe after Ben-Hur or Cleopatra, these were the next biggest purpose-built sets in the history of
Or Wicked?
Wicked.
Wicked. Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, they're massive. They're absolutely...
Wow.
Not only the interior stages at all at Leavesden, but these exterior ones built out in Ivanhoe. And the preparation for them, like they took over this massive farm and planted endless fields of flowers so that they would come at the... in springtime when we were out there shooting. And
amazing.
They built a huge lake in which Ariana and myself and an actor playing her mother arrive on a boat to deliver her to Shiz University. I mean, just extraordinary. And I remember when I first heard about it during, you know, early rehearsals and costume fitting, so on, I went, oh, great, what location? So we'll be shooting on a lake? I went, no, we've built a lake. Right. Okay. I see. So the scale ambition of this film is huge. And I think I'm right in saying this is the biggest greenlit project Universal have ever done.
Wow.
And I think it's because they hope it will have life. Because they don't have, I don't think they have a sort of franchisable commodity themselves. They don't have a Star Wars or a Harry Potter or a... So I think they're rather hoping that these two films might do as well as they are gambling on, and then the world can continue to expand. Because I'm not a big musical theatre fan, and I have seen Wicked a long time ago, but I don't
recall... It's good you've done your research for the role.
Yes, exactly.
You've got method.
Fully method on that. I don't recall the parents being, you know...
I was going to say, I don't think they're in the play. They might be... I think it started as a novel, and then it was into a musical, but I don't know. But it does sound like you've originated this role in a 20-something year-long production, which is an incredible feat in itself.
It's a very generous perspective. But as I say, if there's even a half a frame of me in the final cut...
Don't be too modest about this.
I'll be amazed.
There'll be a fan edit.
There is a very strange Wicked connection that I do have, though. I went off... One of the plays I did do off-Broadway was Alexei K. Campbell's brilliant play called The Pride with Ben Whishaw and Andrew Riseborough and Hugh Dancy at the time. And it was directed by a brilliant actor and director called Joe Mantello. And of course, Joe Mantello directed the original Wicked. So it's sort of almost come full circle.
Yeah.
And the theatre company that we did The Pride for, it's a brilliant company called MCC. One of the artistic directors and founders of it is a guy called Bernie Telsey, who's a huge New York casting director, who also happened to cast Wicked the movie. So it's a little incestuous, but it's a little fate. Yeah, yes, it is fate.
Fate, incest, two sides of the same coin. I've heard from I think it was Bowen Yang, who's also in the production.
Yes,
I think it was him who described it as, even though it's this beast of a production, it has a feel of like an indie film in terms of how excited everyone is and the camaraderie of spirit for the cast and crew. Does that track from your experience?
It did. I was amazed at, given the scale of the production, how remarkably accessible and seemingly very calm, cool and collected John M. Chu, the director, was. And playful. I was thought, God, he would have endless execs breathing down his neck, and there was not a bit of it. It was a very, very happy set on the short time that I spent on it, despite its scale. So I think that's fair to say. And a great love for it. I think, Ariana made it plain to me that she really had to jump through the hoops to win the role. And she wanted to do it as well, because I think it's been something that's been very close to her heart since she was 10, perhaps, when she first saw it. So, there was a great love and care of it, I felt, when working. So I think that would be fair to say.
Incredible. Well, I join the billions other excited to see it when it's finally it's finally out later this year, November. I think
strike, I think it'll be November 24. I don't think that's shifted yet. I think they had always had plans to maybe pick up and do some reshoots next February.
Sure.
But whether they've got to finish the film as well, it will all depend on how this very important strike gets finally resolved and settled, hopefully.
We're rapidly approaching, so I'll go to my final question.
Oh gosh,
which is the likes.
You've got a glint in your eye, Dom. Is this where I get myself totally cancelled?
If you manage to avoid the stories about what happened on Much Ado, you're fine. You're golden now.
I'll share that with you at a later date.
I look forward to that. I'll try not to wear a wire during that lunch. My final question, Adam, which I ask every guest on the show.
Yes.
Why do we need stories?
I think it's just an innate human instinct to want to see life reflected back in us. I think it's both important, comforting, moving, nourishing to witness and be told and tell stories for our very nature. I think it helps put the world, increasingly confusing it as is, into some sort of perspective. It is a necessary place to highlight, spotlight, articulate things that may be going on in the world. And it's a place to escape as well, to be transformed or set free in lots of different ways. And we've been telling stories for as long as we've existed. So there's something about, having the human condition reflected back at us is a necessary process, I think. I remember just before lockdown, I managed to bring my wife to see here Robert Lepage's Seven Streams of the River Ota, a sort of 7-hour, half-day, full-day experience. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was theatre at its best. Totally immersive, utterly compelling. And I think spanned every theatrical discipline, from no theatre kabuki to mime to puppetry to contemporary dance, opera. It was so life-affirming and fulfilling and thought-provoking. And that's why we need the stories and the storytellers.
What a beautiful full circle of this whole interview. I'll bring it right back to the National.
Thank you.
Adam James, thank you so much.
Dom. Thank you very much for having me. I'm so sad we didn't have more time. Maybe we'll do a part two.
Let's do a part two.
Adam,
thank you so much.
Pleasure.